Hey, just tell me when we start recording, though. I assume this was all practice.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to APIs Unplugged. My name is Matt McLarty. I'm the global leader of API strategy for MuleSoft. And as always, delighted to be joined by co-host, Mr. Mike Amundson. Mike, what's up?
Hey, not much. Holding forth here in Kentucky as usual. I'm in a pretty good mood. It's sunny and warm. I'm looking forward to today.
I'm jealous. It's in Vancouver. It's pouring rain. I think it may be raining for one of our guests, but I'd just like to announce that today on APIs Unplugged, we're making history. We have not one, but two special guests for the first time.
All right.
And they're very special guests. We were just remarking that it was about a little over 5 years ago, four of us were holed up in a haunted hotel room that was opened up and dusted briefly by the staff there in New Jersey, writing a book on microservice architecture for O'Reilly. Our guests today are Ronnie Mitra, Director of Technology, publicist Sapient. Ronnie, welcome to APIs Unplugged.
Thanks, Matt.
And Irakli Natarishvili, who is Vice President of Core Innovation at Capital One. Irakli, welcome.
Hi, everybody. Great to be spending this time with you all.
Awesome. So we wrote that book 5 years ago, looking at this new hot trend, microservices, although I guess technically 2021 is the 10-year anniversary of kind of that software architecture conference in Venice, when the whole microservice architectural style was recognized. And then a couple of years later, James Lewis, Martin Fowler published the Blicky post on microservices, and things went hog wild from there. But so, yeah, we're a decade into microservices, and this is kind of the theme of what we're going to talk about. What do microservices look like in 2021. But the great news is, Ronnie and Irakli, you've just published a book for O'Reilly, Microservices Up and Running. And so, you know, authoritative sources on where we are with microservices in 2021. Before we go there, just wanted to get an update. You know, we were all colleagues, teammates in the API Academy at the time we wrote the microservice architecture book. What's been going on for you guys since then? Irakli, you kind of left first. So give us an update on what's happened in your days since being in the API Academy.
Yeah, so it's been a very eventful several years, obviously, not just for me, but last year, I guess, was eventful for everybody. But specifically on the professional side, after leaving Academy, I got involved into starting a startup, and we had a lot of fun with that, and then I ended up joining Capital One. But I've been working on a whole bunch of stuff, all of them related to microservices and building cloud-native systems using microservices in particular. Most recently, I have been responsible for cloud modernization of our core banking systems, which are the systems of record for account and transaction data.
That's awesome, Irakli. Great stuff. I think, you know, leading innovation at Capital One, which I think it's fair to say is always viewed as being quite an innovative player in the financial services space, is a pretty big scope. And it's awesome to see what you've been up to there. So, Ronnie, how about you? What has been your experience in the professional world of microservices and APIs since leaving the API Academy?
Well, people may not know this. This is the longest that you and I have been apart. So it took me a while to get over that.
I don't know. I'm still not over it. I'm not over it.
I've been spending so much time at home. Built a golf simulator in the back garden. But if you're asking about like work-wise, it's been a big shift from, you know, talking about what people could do, and now in my role at Publicis Sapient, where they do a lot of digital transformation work, helping, you know, big banks, big enterprises, retailers, manufacturers do some of this stuff for real. It's been like just fascinating when it goes from saying what you should do to actually trying to get there and the challenges that go along with that. So that's been me for the last two years.
So I'm fascinated by a couple of things. First of all, that you would lead with a golf simulator. So obviously it's taken up a large portion of your time, which I think is probably a good idea. But I also, I think that one of the things you pointed out, which was something all four of us talked about over and over again, was this notion of the difference between actually implementing these things in real life and talking about them and doing the research and collecting the data. So the two of you have released this up and running book with O'Reilly, which is Microservices Up and Running. And I was lucky enough to read some of the early drafts. It's incredibly specific and opinionated. I mean, it's very different than the kind of work we did. What was that like to actually put together a book that talked about how to actually get them up and running? And what are some of the things that really stands out in that book for you guys? I'll start with you, Ronnie, again, since you've spent so many different roles at different organizations. So what's it been like to actually work on this book?
Sure. So if any of you have met us in real life, you know the reason this book is opinionated is because of O'Reilly, right? So that strong vision. The previous book that all four of us wrote together really had, I'd say, more of a philosophical angle, really what the root of this stuff is, and fantastic for that. But with O'Reilly and I, what we had agreed was we wanted to put something together that was much more execution-oriented. And if you ever want to write a book, don't write that kind of book. Because that is so much harder. The other kind is a lot easier. So it's been tough, but I think at the same time, I'm really happy with how it turned out in terms of practical advice that helps you learn how to do this thing that's really broad, complicated, complex, and difficult to do.
Rackley, what's your sort of take on that? I mean, you again, sort of like what Ronnie says, you've always been a strong believer in being specific, being direct, and getting stuff done. What was it like to actually put that into book form with all of the experience you had at Captain?
Yeah, I mean, as you all know, some of the best and worst things always happen from scratching personal itch, right? Mm-hmm. So after leaving Academy, at the Capital One, I had to build actual systems using microservices and was responsible for those things. And what I kept running into as we would hire new people or bring people on who were new to microservices, we always wanted to point them to some book where we would say, okay, go read that, and that will give you a good idea what we expect you to be doing. Mm-hmm. And while there are a lot of really good books about microservices, including the book that we wrote together, they were kind of on two extremes, right? So some of them were maybe very broad, right? Explaining the concepts or the patterns and strategy and architecture, but not necessarily telling you like end to end, what do you do day by day, right? How you start, continue, and finish a project. Or on the other end of the spectrum, there are also a lot of books that are like microservices in Python or microservices in Java, like going maybe a little bit too specific, right? So as soon as you now need to do microservices in Go, like you cannot reuse anything from the microservices in Java book, right? And that's kind of what got us started. And I was also lucky to then spend some time at Temple University in Philadelphia teaching a course about this, and that gave some initial amount of content, thanks to my wonderful students, of what this could look like. And then Ronnie and I talked, and I always believe that writing a book alone is a nightmare. So I was really glad that he actually was courageous enough to do it with me, and really appreciated it. And so we set out on writing that book that would be literally, okay, if you need to build a microservices system, what does that look like? Like, how do you start? What it feels like while you're in it, and like how do you finish it, take it to the successful end.
Awesome. And you guys are still talking to each other, I think. So that's good.
I don't know
if
Ronnie really is talking to me as much, but I still like him. Well, you'll have to ask him about this.
No, that's great. I think it is. I think certainly it's an ambitious scope that you've you've laid out, but an important one, because I totally see that. I think we've always had this sort of split in the microservices world, where like this gap between the big thinking and the execution, and at the execution level, as you pointed out, like a lot of it gets down to into guidance on how do I build an individual microservice. But what I think is great about the book you guys have written is it's actually saying, well, you can't just look at individual services. Like, let's look at the big picture, and let's, you know, give the thinking behind it, and then put that into context and put it into execution. So definitely highly recommended for our listeners.
Definitely.
Now going back to something I mentioned earlier, right? Maybe this is a bigger, framing topic for the book and everything else, is that we are at this remarkably at this 10-year point of microservices. And I remember our Slack discussions when microservices was first becoming a big thing after the Fowler Lewis post. And I was being cynical, saying, wait a minute, it's SOA all over again. And, you know, there's a lot going on. It had a huge impact. And what's amazing is even I think between the time of that Blicky post and now, we've had this huge unfolding of, I think Docker was the hot thing then, and then all of a sudden it got subsumed by everyone being excited about Kubernetes, and then serverless became a big deal, and service mesh in the Kubernetes ecosystem, and you've got observability. Like, there's all these trends that sort of branch out of microservices. And I guess, you know, like, where are we with microservices now? Are we into that trough of disillusionment in your experience working with companies? Is it still hip? Is it still with it? Like, you know, where do you see the world in microservices in 2021? I'll start with you, Irakli, this time.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I think that absolutely microservices will go through those usual phases of technology adoption. I would like to think that we are at the state in microservices where we're not in disillusionment, but we're more like we understand it much better and know how to use it and how to actually get benefit out of it. So hopefully approaching the majority adoption pace. But it will, just like any other technology, it will obviously go through the cycle, and at some point it will not be hip. The point is, I think that we have seen a lot of cycles around a lot of technologies, and there are things that are temporal and there are things that are more kind of forever, right? And I like to think that there are some aspects of microservices that stand the test of time. And I think those are the same aspects that we have used elsewhere and we know it works, right? So starting all the way from lean manufacturing, like way before software engineering, this concept of if you want to execute some complex thing and don't create bottlenecks, you want to reduce the batch size of the work in progress product, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're setting up an industrial line, you want to make sure that each step is producing like a small batch of something and not trying to create a big thing, which then was taken to process management in an agile, right? We try to have short cycles, or there are similar concepts in DevOps with like continuous integration, continuous deployment. We try to release smaller chunks and try to avoid these big bang releases where so many things can go wrong. And I have always seen and percepted microservices to be applying the same concept to the architecture design, right? Mm-hmm. Trying to design in small chunks. So instead of having this huge design artifact of the entire system, trying to identify autonomous parts of designable units of production and try to design them in a way that, and it will all need to still add up to the bigger thing, but create the small batches of work in the design space, just like we have done in the process, as well as deployment in other areas of software engineering.
Yeah, I just want to, you hit on something that, because I said I really enjoyed the book. And one of the reasons I enjoyed the book is you really do talk about like what it really takes to start, continue, and finish. And one of the things that stood out for me in the book, and I want to address this to Ronnie, is you guys have this thing that you talk about that I had not seen in any other book about microservices. And Matt touched on this notion of it's not just a service. You guys talk about an operating model, right? Which I thought was really fascinating, which goes well beyond the technology or the IT part, sort of like what Irakli, you're saying about where this comes from and lean and small batch. So Ronnie, can you tell me what is that operating model about, and why did you think that was important to include in this book about getting up and running?
Yep. Matt, you referenced, what is it, the trough of disillusion, the hype cycle.
Yeah.
I mean, the truth is, I think we're like in the bubble of delusion with microservices. Forget about, the hype cycle. Because like, unlike cloud or Kubernetes or anything like that, anyone can self-identify as having a microservice, right? I don't need permission to tell you I have microservices. So I can have the same monolith on Monday and tell you it's a microservice on Tuesday. And I can give you any explanation I want for that. And you can't tell me otherwise. So you're not going to get disillusioned by something that you've kind of created your own fantasy goal and definition for. And unfortunately, there's not an Irakli in every organization, right? A lot of these organizations are filled with people who are just trying to get some projects out the door. Microservice is something they need to adopt in order to stay relevant, in order to be using the latest technology. So you can kind of fake it. Not through malicious reasons or anything like that, but just because if the goal was just to have microservices, well, that's an easy goal to fulfill. Coming back to your question, Mike, the reason we talk about operating model and some of those other pieces is because to really get to the benefit and the kind of better world that Irakli was describing, you need to do more than just have some code that you can deploy in a container. You really need to tie it to the way people are working. And we try to make that point in the book that the goal is almost always with these things to reduce coordination costs in these big companies. Like how do you create a software system where when the business asks for something to change, people can change it without having 10,000 meetings and 6 months of planning, right? How do you create a system where people can act autonomously, make a change, test it, and deploy it as much on their own as possible without breaking everything around them, right? And it's that kind of goal, continually optimizing towards that goal, that for us, that's the heart of what this is about. And the operating model perspective or the team topologies perspective or, whatever you want to call that thing, that part where you start looking at the people who do the work, for us, that's really key to making this a success.
So, on that note, one of the things that always strikes me as a gap is that we're always talking about, Conway's law and the relationship between people, process, technology, and, you can't just come up with a new whiteboard diagram of the systems and expect you to get the benefits because there's all these people relationships and so on. Like, have you found organizations where the responsibility for architecting the organization is kind of well defined and well understood? This is something that's just kind of, I think, is so important. Every angle that you come at this from, like as we go, companies talk about digital transformation, they talk about going more DevOps, and like whether you're coming at it from the DevOps and methodology and culture perspective or from the microservice architectural perspective, there's always this piece about the topology of the organization, the structure of the organization. Like, have you seen a recognition out there that's important, and that like either executives embrace that role of designing the organization the way an architect might design a software system, or is it architects who are responsible for that? It just seems like, I don't know, my experience is people do reorgs, and what they do is they just change reporting assignments, and that doesn't really change the structure of the organization. So I'm just, it's a thought. It's something that's really so fundamental to that goal of reducing coordination. And you see, different kind of radical organizational approaches at Amazon and others, but is that something that you see people recognizing how important it is and thinking about addressing?
So definitely people know that there's there's a way that you can have an organization that is reflective of software architecture. People have heard of Conway's Law. People get this stuff. I don't know that everyone or anyone knows how to do it. Like, how? What's the model where you just get that? And the truth is, if we're honest, that doesn't exist outside of software either, right? Like, the prime minister doesn't have much to do with my day-to-day activities in the house, right? There's no such thing as a centralized, I'm mastering the design of the entire complex system, and from my hands and my vision, I shape the thing, right? That doesn't exist in real life. So that's I think we're starting to awaken to that in the industry. I see a lot more executives who kind of acknowledge that. They see their job as putting in the constraints or the features or the things that will shape and move things towards a goal. But, you know, they're facing the classic problem so many of us face, is that that kind of transformation is pretty long-term and big. But everyone has quarterly results to achieve, and everyone has deadlines, and everyone has to show value quickly. So the skill that I think we all have to fill is how do you do those small steps that add value, but it takes you towards the big thing, right? And I don't think there is a set version of that. But coming back, you know, to the micro scale, the stuff we can do with the microservices and those architectures and the operating models give you a little bit more freedom and flexibility to do that, to take the small steps towards the big vision.
Yeah, I think that kind of circles back to that whole thing about, like, one of the things I like about what you two do in the book is focus on this operating model, on this this idea of small chunks, on this thing of you sort of, and you talk about it in other sections of the book too. I think if I remember, there's a thing on sort of setting up the developer for success. What tools to be available? There's a lot in the book about how to make things available, make things not necessarily tell people what to do, but give them lots of opportunity. And Irakli, I can't help but think, because of your work, especially at Capital One, but in startups as well, that a lot of this comes from real experience. You're working in a complex organization, as thousands of people in it. You're working in a regulated space. What are the things that you can share, like, specifically with our listeners about, you know, lessons you've learned in terms of what it takes to actually make this work at scale, to do that innovation at scale?
I think this goes back to also the previous question of who cares and who gets this done. I don't think that it is really stakeholders, like executives at a large company or even smaller company, that need to understand or care about, like, intrinsic details of how to set up autonomous teams or how, like, bed sizing or any of them work. And I don't say it in any, like, criticizing manner. Like, it really, they should be concentrated on what's the business value and how do we achieve that, and how do we manage risk in a big way, right? So not manage risk as in never take risk, but how do you take risk and not have it explode in your face, right? And they should always be looking into any tool, any technology, any architecture. How is it supporting that goal? Because that's really the goal of business, and pretending that it's anything else is counterproductive, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes we, the technologists, think that we have all the answers, and every answer to everything is a technological one, right? Mm-hmm. And it's only halfway true, right? It is if it moves the needle on the strategy and the business. So I don't think the stakeholders are the ones. I do think that it's probably somewhere at the level of like technical leads, like program managers, product leaders. And there is no one set formula. Like, one of the challenging things about this is there is no even like two pizza teams or any other way that you can describe what the size and the shape of the organization should be. I think the best way to approach is to understand, what are you trying to achieve? Like, what do you want to see? If it works, what do you expect will happen, right? Is it autonomy in decision-making? Is it less incidents in production? Is it higher scalability system? Is it producing new technology faster? Like, define some of those goals and have then the way to measure whether you are actually achieving these goals, right? I think that most of the time people fail not doing one or the other, right? Either they kind of have the goals but don't know how to measure their progress towards it until it's either done or they have failed, right? So how to measure the progress before you achieve the goal, I think, is extremely important, right? And we have provided some clues in that regard, both in the original book we all wrote together as well as the new book, which is, I really think it's all about coordination costs, right? Mm-hmm. Complex systems cannot be built by a handful of engineers. It's usually a big effort, right? And you will have multiple teams, you will have multiple engineers. So how do you make sure that dependencies between different parts being built at the same time don't either derail you completely or slow you down incredibly, right? So how do you manage those coordinations and how do you create enough autonomy of the teams to address that specifically? Not the autonomy for the sake of autonomy, but really measuring what is my coordination cost across the teams, across engineers right now, and how independent and autonomous teams are. And is that actually helping either my bottom line or time to market or reliability, resiliency, number of incidents, those kind of things. You have to tailor all of those things for your organization by using this like basics of measuring and goal setting, define what works for you, which will also change in time. Like the kind of things, the kind of organization we had 2 years ago at the outset of the big program that I'm responsible for, we had to adapt it at least a couple of times. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think that's it. I remember you, Irakli, one of the first things you were on with microservices, you know, years ago was, this is all about reducing the cost of coordination. And so, you know, prophetic, because you're now doing it, you're implementing it, and you're finding that's kind of the highest leverage point or the, you know, the North Star to aim for. So, and I might argue that I think that executives maybe should care about how things are being done and not just what is being done, you know, the Bezos mandate and all that. But I think that, you know, this is you've given an example where, you know, putting that focus on reducing coordination costs is paying off and kind of the persistence around it. So for you, Ronnie, right, where you're actually working with multiple customers, you know, what I think we all know that microservices can be such a broad scope and has so many little holes to go down that there's all sorts of ways companies can get derailed on things. But have you been able to observe like patterns, like success patterns with microservices now? Like, are there just things that you know, if you just stick to this part of it, it's going to work? Or, and of course, the flip side of that is anti-patterns, right? Where you just know it's going south.
Yeah, totally. You know, I think to tell you the truth, you start doing this microservice thing, you're going to get more good than bad at pretty low risk, right? And the truth is, because you start with pulling the microservice thread and you end up with these things that have become almost like de facto success criteria. You end up with things like cloud, you end up going into the world of event-driven architectures and integrations, you end up with CI/CD pipelines, all of these good things that we know are leading to success, right? But what's been interesting for me to observe is the same challenges seem to come up a lot when people do this. The first challenge seems to be not from the microservice level of how big the box should be, because a few years ago, I thought that's what people would really have a challenge with, right? Like, how do I build the right size microservice? It turns out no one is measuring or paying attention enough for that to matter. Like, I wish that was a problem people concerned. It turns out no one pays attention. But where it does start to matter is when you take a bunch of these together and they start to form a bounded context, an aggregate boundary, a domain, whatever you want to call that kind of collection of things. How do you group these? And then how do you align that group with the right team? And I think that's where we get into this domain-driven design world, this world where you know, the way we structure ourselves is going to have a massive, massive impact on our ability to deliver business value, right? Because the way we structure ourselves needs to align with the strategy of the business, because the way they're going to describe change, you know, needs to be reflected in the platform, the architecture we build. What can we push out of here? What can we keep inside? So that seems to be one of those things that happens. And organizations that don't start with at least some kind of vision of a blueprint of what that should look like, they grow organically. And sometimes organically what develops is not something that's good. Mm. Right. So that can be a challenge, like growing a garden where you don't have a plan. The other, like, getting into more detail thing that always seems to come up. We're now at a point, you talked about how Docker changed everything. I'm noticing that with React becoming this technology everyone's using for front end on web, and the way the browser has changed, we're seeing this big push of micro front ends, right? Mm-hmm. And as soon as I start doing micro front ends, I'm decomposing the front and I've decomposed the back. People are scratching their heads looking at this and saying, well, if I've decomposed both the front and the back, why don't I just put the decompositions together? Like, why don't I just do a front to back module that doesn't deliver just APIs? It's a self-contained application that delivers front ends as well. And I just assemble it. This is a massive decision to make, right? Yeah. And I think we're at a point where we're going to see how this plays out. There's challenges with mobile, but we could in a few years be talking about micro applications instead of microservices.
Wow. So let me just make sure I get this. So what you're saying is, because of your experience now, it isn't just, we're not just microing the server-side components, we're microing the front-end components as well. So we're decomposing that front-end. And so the question is, like, where is the composition, or where's the aggregation, or there has to be some way to connect all these bits. What I expected you to say, honestly, is, well, there's going to be some new middleware. But no, you didn't say that. You actually said, we're going to actually start creating, you know, end-to-end kind of experiences. This is that self-contained systems pattern that I think I've heard before as well, right? It's this idea that you're actually building a thread that runs all the way from the start to the finish. And these are going to sort of be independent units themselves. Is that right?
That's right. It's something that I didn't think we would get to that point, but that is now becoming a real option as people start to look at how they build these things.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that's going to be an interesting one to keep an eye on. My hunch is that, you know, optimizing for decomposition of business domains is different than optimizing for user experience. So something Mike alluded to, it's somewhere along the line, composition happens to optimize for user experience, right? I mean, this is kind of like GraphQL becomes popular because people think it's the only way to orchestrate multiple backend calls to optimize a user experience, right? So I think the complexity is going to move somewhere. In this case, I guess the composition is going to move somewhere.
Should your sitemap be your org design, right? Should your dashboard be your, you know, maybe in some places it should.
Yeah, that's the exactly where I was going is like, well, so what is, because we used to say that, right? So you talk about things like reverse Conways and all these other things where I want a certain set of components, so I'll have a certain set of teams. And then when you started talking the way you were, I was thinking, oh, that's a whole nother way to think about teams. And that goes back to your thing about operating model, right? This starts to affect the way you operate. Irakli, I think you must be dealing with this as well. I know from experience, you have lots of operating things going on there in terms of both backend, now front end too, right? So are you seeing similar things? Like, what's your take on this idea about how modularizing front end is taking on such a role?
Yeah, I agree with Ronnie on that. It's a big decision, but maybe disagree on why it's a big decision. I think it's a big decision because it's dangerous, because we don't know what we're walking into, right? I know that people do want absolutely to kind of have one-to-one mapping with, here's my microservice, here's my area on the screen, and I want to make sure that I deliver it as one component, but that assumes, that makes a huge assumption that the boundaries on the back end are the same as boundaries on the front end. Mm-hmm. And the reality that we have seen even before this whole microservices, like I would go all the way back to my time at NPR, we were doing a lot of like write APIs once, we use it everywhere. That mapping is not always one-to-one, right? Mm-hmm. And if you make them one-to-one, you significantly can hurt your ability to reuse capability. So maybe you have two different screens, two different areas where you could be using the same capability from the backend. But if you have tightly coupled the backend with the frontend, how are you going to do that? Right? So there are all these problems that come up if we take some of the paradigms too far. And I'm not saying that it's not doable. I'm just saying that it's a really poorly understood area for the time being. And I would highly advise that people are going into it with their eyes wide open, because tight coupling is something that usually hurts you, right? So you should be very careful to use that big tool if you really need it.
Yes, and actually you mentioned a word that had not actually come up in this particular podcast, which I find is amazing, APIs. Like we went this whole like 30 minutes and we haven't talked about APIs. And that's kind of where we're sort of making this difference, right? Or actually right now we're using the APIs of the services and the APIs for the front ends as a way to start to communicate with each other. So, I mean, in sort of an odd kind of way, microservices sort of depend on this notion of an API ecosystem. They depend on you, as you mentioned, and you talk about in the book, they depend on actually making those capabilities available. Capabilities are what we're trying to do, right? So do you think it's now been a decade, in all these several years, do you think just even the nature of the way we think of APIs has changed because of this decomposition of services? And I'll start with Irakli on this one, since we were sort of already talking about this. What do you think? Are APIs different than they were 5 years ago?
Thanks for that question. We actually had to address that question head on in our latest book, The Microservices Up and Running, the one we did with Ronnie.
Yeah.
Because things have become very blurry. What is an API and what is a microservice?
Yeah.
There are way too many people we come in contact with that basically say, oh, like small APIs are microservices, right? Mm. And the reality is much more complex, and there's really actually no right answer, right? So microservices clearly are a type of API, right? That like it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck. It's probably a duck, right? It's over HTTP or the same protocols that APIs are. It looks very much like APIs. So what is the difference? Like, is it just small APIs? So we had to address that in the book, because otherwise we could not get the conversation going. And we have a very specific take on it. I'm not saying it's the way to look at it, but it's a specific way to look at it that has worked for us, and which is the one that we advocate in the book. The take is your implementation in any well-designed system, your implementation is different from your interface, right? How you from outside should be different how you actually implement something. So we advocate for the vision where microservices is how you implement your systems, right? Versus APIs is how people see your system from outside. So APIs would be calling microservices, and they are not the same thing in that definition. Right.
Right.
So that's how we solved it. Obviously, that's not going to be the solution for everybody, but I do genuinely believe that the emergence of microservices does not negate the need on good API design and API management. It's more complementary than something replacing APIs. Just because you're doing microservices shouldn't mean that you are not doing APIs now, because we have microservices. Why do you need APIs?
Right. And that also touches on another thing that I really like about the book. The two of you in this microservices up and running, you actually say, look, we're going to give you, we started this conversation this way, we're going to give you a very opinionated view of it. We're trying to optimize for a certain set of things. So here's how we're going to solve those problems. And you even mention in the book that when you want to start optimizing for other things, you may have to come up with another result, but you can use some of the same models or patterns. And Ronnie, I think that's something that I'd kind of learned from you for you know, over the years, this idea that there's always a variation, like Irakli is saying, when it comes down to implementing for your personal case, there are always optimizations you make. So from your standpoint, is this, I mean, are APIs kind of taking on a different role, or are they just being thought of differently as we get more mature on the service side? What is your take on this?
If I'm honest, the question, what's an API, what's a microservice, doesn't keep me up at night. I don't really care. What does get me thinking is, you know, what is the purpose of these things? What are you optimizing for? How are you changing the decisions you make? Now, obviously, we provide a definition because definitions help. It's helpful to have names that mean things. And then when we refer to these things in the book, it's useful. And there's decisions you need to make, right? That's the other reason it's useful to highlight it. You know, the truth is that the approach we took, it's a little bit like if you want to learn to ride a bike or play tennis, something like that, you can't just sit and learn about how to do these things and then go do it, right? Because these are complex activities that require you to move your body in a certain way, use your muscles in a certain way. And you can learn a little bit, but you have to try. So what we've done here is, you know, in this opinionated, guided way, holding your hand, we take you through this work. You get to implement microservices. You get to create an API. You get to do CI/CD pipelines. You get to do all these things. And the idea is, as you do them, you start to get a feel for, wow, this decision matters because look what happened because I made that decision, right? So you get that kind of accelerated experience. And maybe you do it again after that, but change some of the decisions, right? Which is one of the reasons we highlighted decision records. These are these points. You make a decision. Like Irakli said, you know, if you decide to do a boundary that includes front-end UX, there's an impact to that decision. And whether that's right or wrong is going to depend on your context, right? But once you get a feel for, wow, these are important decisions, then you can start to, on your next build, plan ahead, predict the future, think about what might happen if I do it that way. You know, pay attention and start measuring. So, you know, by the time you have to do this for real, you've already done it two or three times, feel a little bit more confident, ask the right questions, and end up a bit more successful.
So effectively, you've built the golf simulator for microservices. That's awesome. But thanks. Listen, this has been a great discussion. I know the four of us could talk all day. I guess Irakli and I generally talk for 2 hours at a time on weekends during soccer games. But no, this is, I think it's, you know, I think it's pulling the curtain back a little bit on what microservices are like in the wild. I think that you've shared some of your experiences, which are both, I think, being closer to the implementations, but also just the maturity and understanding of microservices in the industry is being reflected now as people realize that, oh, okay, some of these principles are time-worn principles that had other names in previous generations, or as you said, Ronnie, like microservices is kind of the gateway to these other technologies. So I think it's been really helpful to hear your experiences, and it's just been great chatting again. So Irakli, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun.
And of course, Mike, thanks as always.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And it's been a fantastic session. The chance to hear you two and sort of get behind of what I've been reading. I really enjoy the book, Microservices Up and Running, and really encourage people to read it. And it's great to catch up. Thank you very much.
Awesome. And thanks to the listeners. Hope you've enjoyed this episode, and we look forward to bringing you the next one on APIs Unplugged. Bye.